Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. Welcome back. In this episode, I'm going to continue the discussion of the many ways I think animal-assisted therapy can become diagnostic. What I mean by that is there are ways that animals signal non-verbally to us reflections of our own internal emotional states. And if we can start learning how to decipher this information, we will be able to increase the effectiveness of therapy overall. Since they do not have the same verbal complications we bring to session, my feeling is that animals can act as a more objective partner to assist the therapist in discerning all these nonverbal signals. Psychology, in particular psychoanalysis, has done a tremendous amount of work to illuminate the transferring of feelings in therapy. However, the complication is that often these feelings are unconscious for the patient, and so they are difficult to speak about and explore. An opportunity to help gain more knowledge lies in the fact that most of these feelings will show up in our bodies as nonverbal signals. And the way this works is rooted in the same physiology that we share with mammals. And since our animal friends can read us somewhat, and perhaps we can share with them a common understanding of emotions, as we saw in episode 7 with Jane Goodall and Mr. Greybeard, the chimpanzee she first had an encounter with, along with in that episode, we heard from divers who felt they could sense something about the whales they encountered, then very likely to me, much more is being communicated across species than we currently realize. My proposal is that we consider the animals we partner with in therapy as diagnostic indicators of the nonverbal transference of the internal experiences, that is, the thoughts and feelings of our patients. While they may not be able to describe the content, their bodies will pick up and reveal the associated emotions of the patients, because animals share the same physiology in nervous systems that we have. What I'm suggesting here is that we take this idea, this psychoanalytic idea that suggests that the unconscious things that people bring to therapy, the unconscious experiences they need help with, often relational patterns from their history that are either have or are currently causing them difficulties, those things are transferred in the nonverbal communication between all beings. And that includes between the horse and the human in equine assisted services, as well as the dogs in canine assisted work. So what I'm suggesting then is we start to learn how to read the horse and the dog for those diagnostic impressions that are coming across in that nonverbal transference. Let's get some background and go back to some early psychoanalytic discussions to learn about transference. I'll start with Sigmund Freud, known for founding psychoanalysis, and Carl Jung, who founded analytical psychology. Despite their widely known disagreements, Jung stated in his book, Memory, Dreams, and Reflections, quote, "The main problem of medical psychotherapy is the transference. In this matter, Freud and I were in complete agreement." End quote. In another work, Jung explained Freud's experience of a, quote, feeling-toned memory image that his patient had of their father and then transferred to Freud. If you've listened to this podcast, then you may have guessed that we are also going to refer to Nancy McWilliams, this time in her book, Psychoanalytic Case Formulation, another brilliant one, where she eliminates Freud's assertion that the feeling states of the patients are being transferred to the therapist. The way I think about it is that there is a relational pattern that gets built when we are young. We expect things from others based on our early experiences. If we are lucky enough to have consistency in our upbringing, then we will expect consistency from others. If we grew up with inconsistency, then we expect that from others, as an example. If at home the child is the one who is known for being cute, it is common for their grade school teachers to also remark how cute they are. The idea is that we get accustomed to relational patterns, and then we repeat them with new people we encounter. And McWilliams stated, the less effectively a person can communicate emotional suffering in language, the more powerful his or her nonverbal messages tend to be, end quote. Typically, the transference of feelings, thoughts, emotions is evaluated through the countertransference, which is another way to phrase what the therapist feels in response to the patient's transference. So we have this situation in the therapy session where old relational patterns are being revealed, and the way the therapist currently understands them is through their own feelings of them. The assessments are often muddy. Feelings and emotions are by nature elusive, almost like water. They shift in subtle ways. And as I mentioned in the last podcast, sometimes therapists, okay, let's be real. At all times, therapists bring our own emotions to the therapy session. And this can make things further difficult to assess. So what I'm suggesting here is that we include body movements, nonverbal body movements, into the things that can be evaluated to understand the transference. And I should state, understanding the transference is a fundamental concept of psychoanalytic theory because it's understood to be a way that we can help the patient illuminate those old historical patterns and become conscious of them such that if they aren't serving them, you know, in their life currently, for example, then they can make more conscious choices with other people. And along the way, there's been a huge development of knowledge about how emotions are displayed in nonverbal cues in all mammals that we are currently not using to understand this transference. Jaak Panksepp, the founder of Affective Neuroscience, said, quote, we are finally in an era where most thoughtful investigators agree with Freud's deep belief in the biological foundations of the psyche. Let me explain some ways here that science is catching up to this initial instinct of Freud's. I've mentioned before Stephen Porges. He's the author of the polyvagal theory. And he discussed how the physiology works where our emotions are displayed in our bodies, primarily facial cues. And he shared how the facial muscles display universal signals of social engagement. So when we want to make social bonds, we have to first start with social engagement, and we signal our intent to do that by our facial features. He lists a few different examples, including making eye contact and matching similarity in facial gestures. As an example, you're kind of matching the mood of someone else if you're trying to bond with them. So if they're talking about something exciting, then you also display excitement. If they're talking about something more somber, then you match the tone of their emotional expression so that the feeling is that you're attuned to them. Porges then summarized in his book some studies that show that children who have been maltreated or institutionalized will typically do two things in the response to social engagement. They typically underassess social interactions that are risks to their safety, and they typically display defensiveness towards social bonding that could be more safe. I'd like to give a fictional example of this concept to help it come to life. Most therapists who work with children who have experienced a difficult upbringing will typically have a situation along these lines at some point in their career. Maybe a great rapport is built over time with the child patient. Eventually, they trust you and you trust them. Sessions are tough in terms of content, like what's being discussed, but they tend to be smooth in the rapport between you and your patient. Then imagine you work at a large agency, and after session, you're walking the child back to the waiting room. You might even still both be smiling as you walk down the hall toward the reception desk for their next appointment to be made. As you approach the waiting room, your sense of ease remains because at your workplace, you feel comfortable. But you notice your child patient's body starts to tense up as you approach the reception desk, where the receptionist and the child's caregiver, for this fictional example, let's assume it is their foster parent, are both waiting. The receptionist looks at you first to get your social cues on the next steps. She asks, "Ready to schedule the next appointment?" You nod in agreement and turn to see that all of a sudden, the child who is next to you is now totally different. Their smile has tensed up into a slight scowl. Eye contact that they were making in session with you has now vanished. In fact, now you can't even see their eyes because they will only look at the floor. They only provide one-word replies, even grunts, to the receptionist and their caregiver. And sadly, then, you notice the adults in the room doing the same thing. The receptionist, who started off with an open smile, has closed her social cues, and she is now staring at her computer monitor. After your patient and their caregiver leave, the receptionist asks you what she did to make him mad. This happens often for children in therapy. They can develop a great rapport with their therapist, but unless those body behaviors and facial cues start to become conscious, or better yet, the assessment of actual threat and non-threat become more accurate, without those things, then their normal unconscious modes of relating will remain, and the feeling of not being safe gets reinforced in social situations. So what happened? In this example, the therapy office had become a safe space after a few months of consistent therapy. So the child is able to relax with you as their mental health therapist. Yet, the experience of coming into a waiting area, even though walking with you, is still the experience of a non-safe situation because there are strangers in there. So their nonverbal facial cues are going to reflect their internal state, which has shifted from the ease of safety to the need for defense as you walk down the hallway together. Sometimes you can start to pick it up as you're walking because there will be a synchronization in footstep patterns, typically between two people who are comfortable with each other. And as you get further and further from the therapy office, the gait of your child patient starts to stiffen and the patterns become different by the time you reach the reception desk. Was he actually mad at the receptionist? Likely not. He was more likely defending against being vulnerable in a social situation. So his social cues on his face are starting to shut down. However, now she is going to defend by protecting herself from being vulnerable. And so he will likely have a similar experience, maybe that she was mad. This is what I'm talking about in terms of the idea of transference. The feeling tone just transferred across the room. And if we leave it at a feeling, it starts to feel personal. It can even feel like a personal attack. However, let us consider that it is simply a miscue of nonverbal body language. This is a child who's in the foster care system, so we can guess that he might have similar experiences to the research that Porges summarized, in that he's going to underassess actual threats and dismiss people who are trying to social bond with him. Much like Freud's patient related to him as a father figure instead of a therapist, this child has related to an adult as if they are threatening and not the receptionist who is wanting to help him get another appointment for therapy. This is what I mean by transference of nonverbal body language. He's coming in with a relational pattern and he's used to turning off his social cues as he approaches a social situation. Unfortunately, especially after she was looking forward to making the appointment, the receptionist has now misinterpreted this as being personal to her, that he might be mad. More than likely, this child if he's been in the system for a while, has faced many reception desks, and he may or may not have had an association to this person. So it is if for him the interaction was probably impersonal, almost flat, and for her it becomes personal and intentionally directed toward her. This happens a lot for children who are in the foster care system. The intentions of well-meaning adults get skewed, and as Portis explained, the intent to be helpful is not easily recognized. Things get so muddy and confusing quickly because the nonverbal signals just cued for each person to go on the defensive. However, neither one knows exactly why that happened. Conversely, children in this circumstance will also underassess how threatening some strangers and peers can be. One of the things I looked at in my research project that I provided an overview of in episodes 2, 3, and 4 was how children approached a therapy dog, because I was actually looking for these types of patterns in the approach to see if their internal states could be revealed in the way they approached Maddie, my therapy dog, in the research project. However, what surprised me is that Maddie was the one signaling different things going on with the participants. As I mentioned in one case, Maddie was signaling to me when one of the participants was extremely anxious, and neither myself nor her treating therapist realized it at the time. I've also seen something similar happen in equine assistance services when participants are afraid of insects at the barn. It is not natural for horses to fear flying insects, maybe with the exception of horseflies. But when the human next to them is afraid of wasps or even Miller moths in the barn, and if that fear is intense enough, the horse will start to alert and react similarly to the human. If anxiety and fear can transfer to dogs and horses when they otherwise would not typically display those behaviors, then to me, there is a clear indication here that we need to better understand how this works a lot more. Any therapist who has worked in the field of animal-assisted therapy has many more examples of this point, because it is very common in the industry. It is just that currently these experiences are mostly anecdotal. What I'm suggesting here is that we need to research this phenomenon much more, which is something that I'm planning, and I'm encouraging more people to do so via this podcast. Examples like this are happening in all kinds of therapy sessions, and we are not understanding as much as we could yet. Animals can help illuminate these nonverbal patterns of relationship we each carry with us, especially mammals, because they share much of the same physiology we have as humans, and as such, they communicate with us nonverbally in similar ways. And my suggestion is that by learning to read the nonverbal communication patterns between animals and humans during animal-assisted therapy sessions, this will help us as mental health therapists learn a lot more about how our patients relate and identify specifically how we can help them more. And my hope is that research in this area will not only illuminate working with animals, but also in-office therapy sessions without animals. Essentially, the animals are extending their partnership with us to help us decode the body signals we have, but have yet to draw our attention to. And if we can rekindle our awareness of these subtleties, then the work of therapy can become much, much more helpful. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.